In this hour of the show, we will be talking about something that in the minds of many people might well be a defining characteristic of human beings. And what we are talking about is the need for giving, receiving help. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Garrett Kaiser, and he's the author of a recently published book. It's been out maybe a couple of months now, which is entitled Help, The Original Human Dilemma. And it's published by Harper San Francisco. And here's the way he writes about it early on in the book. He writes this: help cuts about as close to the bone of what it means to be human as any subject I can think of. We are, almost by definition, and certainly from the beginning of our lives, creatures who require a lot of help. No human newborn stands up on shaky legs to suckle its first meal, nor can we imagine a fully formed adult who could qualify as human without giving some form of help to another. Such a person, neither helpless nor helpful, would be less than a robot, more soulless than a stone. And he goes on, and of course we'll talk some more as he explores the subject here in the book. Questions, comments certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local people here in our area. We do also have the toll-free line, however, and if it would be long-distance call for you, use that number. That is 800-222-9455. So, again, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Garrett Kaiser is the author of a couple of critically acclaimed books, one titled The Enigma of Anger and the other A Dresser of Sycamore Trees. He's a frequent contributor to Harper's Magazine. He makes his home in northeastern Vermont. He is, in addition to being a writer, former high school teacher and Episcopal priest. And he's joining us here this morning by telephone. Mr. Kaiser, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Early in the book, you say that you decided that what you wanted to do was to both write about helping and also to read about helping. And in the process of doing the book, I knew that you did a lot of thinking about it and also looked at what other people had written about the subject. So what was it that attracted you to this and made you want to spend as much time as obviously you did thinking about it and then writing about it?
Well, there were several reasons. First of all, I wanted to write a book that would be relevant to anyone who picked it up. Maybe everyone wouldn't like it, but everyone has some helping to do or receive in their life, and so I wanted to write a book that would be relevant to anyone. I also wanted to write a book on a subject that was coming to the fore in my mind as I approached midlife and looked back at some of the things that I had done and began to wonder, where had I been helpful, where had I not been helpful? And also, as I began to realize how indebted I was to people who had helped me. And I also wanted to challenge what I saw as two assumptions of some literature that, you know, goes under the category of self-help, one being that oneself is the most important person there is to help, and the other that all problems can be reduced to easy formula, which once mastered always guarantees success. And I knew that that wasn't true, and I knew a lot of good people who labored to help others and who sometimes got burned in the process. I wanted to write a book that addressed them and also honored them.
Hmm. Well, maybe we might talk here about what would be in a lot of people's minds the archetypal helping story. Perhaps not for everyone, but for a lot of people. And that would be the story of the Good Samaritan. And I'm certain that a lot of people who are listening to us will know the story. Jesus tells this story. And he tells it in response to someone who is asking him essentially the question about, well, you talk about showing compassion and love to other people. And the question is, well, okay, I just want to know, tell me, just to whom am I obligated to show this? Who are we talking about here? And Jesus tells the story, and people will know about the man who is accosted by robbers on the road, and he's robbed and beaten and just left. And a couple of people walk by, they see him, and they just walk on. And the Samaritan comes along and picks the man up and cleans him up and takes him to an inn and says, here, take care of this man, and gives the innkeeper some money and promises that if it costs more, he'll come back and take care of that later. And it seems that the simple lesson to take away from it is that there is no us in them. There's only us. You know, that is, if you ask who you're obligated to love, the answer is everybody. Sorry, no exclusions. But what you do is after reminding people of the story, encourage people to wrestle with it and to say, well, in fact, things aren't really as easy as that. They're not as clear cut as that. Things aren't as simple as that. And what you say in this particular essay is that what you'd like to do is make the story more complicated and see how things might turn out, or at least get people to think about it that way.
Yes, and in so doing, I would like to think, at the risk of flattering myself, that I'm returning the parable to the original intention of the person who told it. I'm so glad that in summarizing that parable, you included its context, that Jesus tells the story in response to a lawyer who wants to know, who is my neighbor? Who am I obligated to care about, and who am I not obligated to care about? And in asking that question, what the lawyer wants is, an easy template that he can lay over every single situation, and he will know exactly what to do and also exactly what he doesn't have to do. And Jesus tells a story that basically explodes that expectation by saying, you have a concrete situation, and you have a concrete decision to make. And that's what you have. And, of course, Jesus is on the side of making that decision in as loving a way as possible. But to take the story of the Good Samaritan then and turn it into a hard and fast rule that we can lay upon every situation is merely to return to the mindset of the lawyer, that is, to move in the direction of some kind of glib and abstract and easy principle and away from the very difficult dilemmas that come about whenever we're facing a situation that's calling for our help.
Hmm. Well, that's, and that gets, I suppose, to the subtitle of the book, that help is the original human dilemma. What in what sense is it a dilemma? Is it past the, you make the decision, do I do something or do I not do anything? Okay, so once you made that decision that you're going to do something, then maybe that's the issue. Then it becomes much more complicated because it involves making other sorts of decisions, perhaps.
That's right. And you've just outlined, an interesting evolution in the action of helping, and I think it's one of the key paradoxes of helping, is that once you've made a decision to help, or at least I've found this true in my life, there's almost an exhilarating sense of clarity that comes with that. You know, you see someone by the side of the road, their car's stalled, you pull up behind them and you get out to help. And right then and there you know that this is the right thing to do and that there's nothing you have to do that's more important than this. So there's that beautiful clarity there, and I think it's meant to be enjoyed. But it's immediately followed then often by some other dilemmas, such as how do we get this thing out of the ditch? What else is needed here? And also, what does this person really want? Help is a dilemma because we as human beings are mysteries, and I think help devolves when we start looking at the people we help as projects or as projections of our own need, whatever that need is, to feel wanted, to feel important, to feel at the center of things. When we do that, instead of looking at the person in all of his or her complexity, and the Good Samaritan story is relatively simple. The needs of the man wounded are obvious. He needs not to bleed to death, and how to help him is fairly simple. He needs to have his bleeding stopped, and he needs to have his wounds bound up and dressed. And the Good Samaritan does that. But in some other situations, such as that of a fifth grade teacher who's facing a kid who comes to school every day in dirty clothes and falls to sleep at his desk when he's there at all, the situation becomes much more complex and it involves some dilemmas.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's certainly very quickly you start going from the basic principle to the reality and thinking about the costs involved in helping, the fact that indeed it may not turn out the way you like. I know a guy who one of his favorite sayings is that no good deed goes unpunished, that in fact there are often unseen consequences, and you may set out to do something and in fact do that thing with all the right intentions, and that somehow things can come back to bite you. It seems kind of unfair, and yet that's the way life is, I suppose.
It is somewhat unfair if we have the sense that life ought to be fair, and we can all cite examples of good deeds that seemed to be punished. Helping is risky, but without the risk, I don't really see how it's all that virtuous either. It's precisely because of the risk that it calls for courage, and the best helpers are people with courage. I think also that as people begin to evaluate why certain helping enterprises blow up in their faces, why the good deeds become punished, they come upon their own need for help. And one of the themes of the book is that helpers also need help, and that when they act in isolation, something that not even the Good Samaritan dares do. I mean, he gets to an inn and gets the help of an innkeeper. That to act in total isolation is to increase the risk. Sometimes you have no choice, but where you have the choice, the helper is benefited by seeking help. And in its ultimate sense, that principle is political. It's the idea that, yes, we can help that kid who's coming to school and has dirty clothes, and we can, you know, maybe help him get some clean clothes or visit his household or bring over a Christmas box or something like that. But ultimately, what would be nice is to create a society in which there's a minimum standard of decent living, and in which there's adequate education, medical care, and also a good and well-paying job for that kid's parents, and that those things... the lack of those things, rather, often lies behind the frustration and the disappointment that we encounter in those helping dilemmas.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is writer Garrett Keyser, and his book is titled Help, The Original Human Dilemma. It's published by Harper San Francisco. And, of course, questions, comments are welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think over time, human beings, human thinkers at least, have spent some time trying to think about and establish things that make human beings unique, or at least that separate us from other animals. And it seems that every time we come across something, it eventually gets knocked aside when we see that, in fact, no. And animals do that thing, too. And there are some people who might be prepared to make the argument that helping is indeed something that separates human beings from other animals. And that's, of course, then you can find examples of animals doing helping behavior, particularly with humans that they're bonded to. But that may not necessarily be the same thing. Do you think that, in fact, that it is something that is unique to humans?
I'm really not sure. I tend to think that it's not. I tend to think that it exists in other species as well. I think in the grooming that we see among primates, we're seeing a primitive form of help. And help is also in the perception of the person helped, which is an interesting thing about it. You know, altruism is something we feel or have in ourselves as doing subjects, but help is an action, and that means that the helped person gets to judge its effectiveness. And I think there's a way of looking at the entire creation, at the entire universe, and seeing it as mutually helpful. I think what distinguishes human help is that its complexity and the amount of consciousness that's involved in it, and the options we have for modifying our behaviors and for modifying culture, for making more helpful cultures or less helpful cultures. I'm not sure that gorillas have that same option, but I'm not sure that we're always behaving in such a way that we are entitled to think ourselves all that superior to gorillas.
You in early on, you have used in our conversation here, you have used the word altruism, but you also write in the book fairly early on that actually you're not writing about altruism, and then go on to admit you're not exactly sure what that means. I guess I have an idea myself, but I didn't go to the dictionary to check to see if what I was thinking about was it. What is the difference between, is there a difference between helping in the way that we've been talking about it and the way that you think about it in the book and altruism, which, and I guess maybe I would say the way I think about that word is that it has something to do with putting your perceived needs aside completely and putting the other person's perceived needs ahead of yours in all respects.
Well, your understanding is very close to the meaning of the word and the etymology of the word. I believe it comes from a French word, alter, for other, and altruism is orientation toward the other. And I don't spend time discussing altruism, first of all, because I'm not qualified to. I'm not a psychologist or someone who can speak with authenticity about human behavior. But I also tend to see altruism as more abstract. It's like talking about love, and I was more interested in talking about the kiss and the embrace. And help for me is an action. And it's an action that I see as involving two people and some sharing of effort, which I'm not sure is always the case with altruism. But when I use the word help, if I were to say to you, I helped my mom up the stairs, and you formed a mental picture of that, you probably would not see me carrying my mom up the stairs, which an altruist might do. But when I say I'm helping my mom up the stairs, you see an image of mom doing some of the work, however much she may be hobbling. And I think that's one characteristic of help. And I think another is something I mentioned before, that in determining what is help, two people get to weigh in. In other words, if I see you shivering on a park bench and I knit you a sweater, I'm an altruist, even if you're allergic to the sweater. But on the question of whether or not I actually helped you, you have something to say about that. Well, it was nice of you to give me the sweater, but frankly, the itching was worse than the cold, and I can't wear it. It was of no help. That doesn't mean that I wasn't trying to be helpful, and it certainly doesn't mean that I wasn't an altruist. But the question of whether or not I helped is something that comes from the other person as well, which is what makes it interesting to me. Help is about relationship. Altruism is about, you know, about one's spirit or one's heart. But help puts it out there between two people.
And I suppose that also suggests one of the pitfalls, and that being that you decide, you yourself take it upon yourself to decide what help that person needs, what is good for them, without perhaps consulting them or trying to figure out what sort of help they feel they need.
That's a very good point, and I think it goes right to the heart of at least what I mean by help and what I would define as effective help. Which includes openness to what the other person actually wants. You mentioned the parable of the Good Samaritan before. Another passage from the Bible that I've always been fond of is where a blind man comes up to Jesus beseeching his help, and Jesus asks him the question, "What do you want me to do for you?" rather than just assuming, "Ah, blind man, I know the problem here." He asks the other person. The Good Samaritan, admittedly, doesn't have that option if the man on the road is lying half dead, but his wounds are probably an eloquent enough statement as to what his need is. But in the case of someone who's conscious and up and moving around, it's a good idea to ask, and sometimes helpers forget that. A physician told me recently that on the average it will take a doctor 17 seconds during an office visit to interrupt what you are saying.
We have a caller. Would welcome others into the conversation. This first person is listening in Eureka on our toll-free line. We'll go right there. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. A very timely topic. I wonder if your guest could offer, and I realize it's maybe out of his area of expertise, but just some general guidelines for those in, quote, the helping professions as they try to render assistance to other people, what he might think in terms of just principles involved there?
Well, I can offer some, and some based on my reflection, and I can even offer a few, sir, that are based on some of the helping professionals that I interview.
I see, sure.
In my
sure.
book. Certainly by being attentive, as I said, to the other person's needs. I think one of the ways that we help is by knowing our own limitations and being clear about them and letting a person know what we're able to do and what we're not able to do. I think by allowing the person to participate as much as possible in the act of helping, and I think desiring the person's independence. I think a sincere act of help, as opposed to something that's a bit sick, carries with it the wish that the action's going to be temporary. You know, if you're a doctor, you want your patient to be well. You don't want your patient to be in the hospital under your care, however gratifying their gratitude and affection for you might be. And then I think you can also be an authentic helper by accepting help when the shoe's on the other foot, which in a long-term relationship usually happens. Some of the people that I talk to, among the things that they said, one of the physicians I talked to said to believe that people are doing the best that they can. A midwife said to know your stuff. You know, the heart is good, but make sure you have the information in your head and you have that down cold. A priest I talked to said always try to keep a vision of the person as they would be if they didn't need the help. And I think that's true, that in help there's a component of hope. And finally, a guidance counselor said to me, try to work through what you love rather than against what you hate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir.
All
thank
right,
you.
Thank you. Let us continue. I think we have someone else in Chicago. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I don't have a question. I just wanted to share a prayer that a friend, I have a very creative friend who's a nun, and one of my favorite prayers is that she says, Lord, let me not be the victim of someone's charity.
And what do you take from that?
I think it's exactly what you said about altruism. Sometimes we don't ask people what they need, and we give them what we want to give them, and in which case the person ends up being a victim rather than a recipient.
Hmm. The prayer makes me think of something that Henry David Thoreau said in Walden, that if he knew someone was coming to his house with the conscious intention of doing him good, he'd head for the woods as fast as he could go.
Yeah, I think it's the same spirit.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Other people who are listening are certainly welcome to call with questions, comments, thoughts as we continue to talk with our guest, Garrett Kaiser. His book is titled Help, The Original Human Dilemma. It's published by Harper San Francisco. It came out a couple of months ago. Certainly you should be able to find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. And again, people are listening. You want to contribute thoughts, you are certainly welcome to do that. I think that we have this idea that the willingness to help is one of those things that we're going to use to decide whether or not we're a good person. That is supposed to be an indication of character or lack thereof. And I think that also attached to that is the idea also that there's a sort of a purity issue that has to do with motivation and that somehow helping is best, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's best when you're doing this with no expectation that you're going to get anything out of it. Maybe not even feeling good, you know, that it should, it's a pure mitzvah, you know, it's something that you do, and the thing that is definitely not part of it is as a motivation is the idea that you're going to get some reward, which gets to this question of to what extent is it okay to derive good feeling, to feel good about helping, or are we really imposing some sort of a strict ascetic code on this that says no, that tarnishes the act. If you're going to feel good about it, that it somehow lessens the act of helping.
Well, I approach that idea the way I approach a lot of other basically good ideas by saying, you know, there's some truth in it, but I begin to react against it when it becomes a dogma. I think that on the issue of motive, there are two opposite dangers temptations, whatever you want to call them, that we can fall into. On the one hand, we can completely ignore our motive and just say, well, I feel good about this and that's enough, and be completely blind to whatever other darker things are playing around underneath the surface, and that can make us dangerous or at least unhelpful people. But I think the other side of that is to carry, to use your word, to take that principle of selflessness and to make it a form of asceticism by which we think if we experience any pleasure in helping, then it must be wrong, which to me is like saying if you experience any pleasure in conceiving a child, then you're not a pure-hearted parent. I think that pleasure is an integral part of life, and that pleasure exists to tell us often when we are doing something that's good for us, which is, you know, the reason we eat and sleep and do other things that are good for us. So I don't think that pleasure itself undermines the integrity of an act of helping. I also think that, though, that there are cases where, you know, there's an absence of pleasure, and there's really even an absence of an altruistic rush, and we're left with nothing but duty. I've attended and been near people who, you know, help relatives to die, you know, help them die at home. And they may love this person they're helping to die very much and care about them. And there may be days when they experience a great deal of pleasure. They share stories. They enjoy moments that in the hurry of their lives they might have missed. At the same time, there are days when it's just hard work, and it's awful, and it stinks, and it's hard. And the only thing that keeps you going is some notion in your head that this is what human beings do. This is what I should do. This is what grandma would have done for me if I were in this situation. And I've just got to get through it. And good feelings alone, including very noble altruistic feelings, sometimes don't carry the whole burden.
Let's talk with someone else. Here's a listener in Pena, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
As a Roman Catholic, I have always understood that acts of charity do count for your, let's say, your soul and your well-being. I have talked to non-Catholic people who tell me that that's not true, and I believe they're probably coming from some teachings of Luther, who was very, shall we say, afraid that this could lead to a misuse of charity. And I've also spoken to ministers and priests about this, you know, how much can you do, you know, to, you know, achieve goodness, shall we say. And they all answered me, never enough. We cannot do enough. We have to rely on the grace of God. And I thought maybe you could reply to some of those things, and I'll just hang up. Thank you.
All right.
Well, there's a lot there, and certainly I'm not qualified to speak on behalf of the Catholic faith or what would constitute charity according to a particular religion. As far as the question of, you know, how much is enough, I think that that's one of the dilemmas that that define help for me. And I think that that's one of the questions that that people who believe, as this gentleman does or seems to, that it's important to help, that it's important to be charitable. It's one of the questions that comes to mind in the lives of those people. I mean, when do you punch out? Not long ago, someone published an article and said, you know, for every $200 you're willing to give to a world relief organization, you can save a child's life. That they'd actually parsed out the math, you know, and come up with that figure. So you send in the $200, and you send in another $200, and then, you know, you're about to go out to eat, or you're about to buy a DVD player, and you look at it and say, well, DVD player or child's life. And I think all of us come up against our own limitations. And, you know, some of us turn to grace and some of us turn to cynicism. Some of us send in the $200. Some of us buy the DVD player and feel guilty about it. For me, one way out of that whole dilemma is just by asking, well, I know my limits, and maybe no amount of charity is sufficient. But frankly, what amount am I able to give? And what I do know for sure is that just debating that question helps no one. But if I make a small step toward my neighbor, even if most of the time I'm watching DVDs, I've still done something more and something better than remaining in the abstract discussion about what constitutes good and what constitutes bad.
Hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that things that having made the decision to help, that sometimes things may happen that are beyond your control, or maybe indeed it was the result of something that you did with the best intentions and it just goes horribly wrong. And there may be maybe people have stories or have read stories of someone who was trying to help another and that somehow it went horribly wrong. And maybe that it didn't have anything to do with the helper, that the problem was the helpee and something about them. And I guess that then one could imagine taking away from that some variety of lessons. One could be that you'd say to yourself, well, I'm never going to do that again. I mean, that is, I'm not going to risk something going terribly wrong again, so I'm simply not going to get involved. You could, I suppose, come away with the thinking, well, somehow if I had done something different, the result had been would have been different. You could come away with it blaming the other person, saying, well, they were just a screw up to begin with, and so there was nothing that I could do that was really going to make any difference, that they were bound to end up dead or in some bad situation, or, you know, that it just wasn't going to work out and it's not my fault, it's that person's fault. I mean, we did talk about this a little bit earlier, but I guess I'm still in this idea of how it is that you sort out bad outcomes and what do you take away as your lesson from the bad outcome? What do you do with that experience?
Well, it's a question that doesn't go away, and I think the really significant questions in life don't. They're repeated again and again. We may evolve better answers, but I'm not sure we ever completely do away with the question. When things go wrong, I think thoughtful people will ask, well, what else could I have done, or well, what else should I have done? And if they come up with some specific rational answers about what might have made the outcome better, then they will probably try to act accordingly in the future. However, if they come up with the answer of, well, I can't really think of anything else that I could have done differently, then the question becomes, well, the next time, because there's going to be a next time that you face that kind of situation, what will you do? And I think, you know, we weigh various things. How much did we suffer ourselves from that bad outcome? How much did we cause suffering? How much are we willing to face that again? And some people will decide, no way, I'm not going there again. And others will decide, well, the outcome can be dicey, but I'd still rather deal with a dicey outcome than the bad outcome that I know will be there if I do nothing. If I don't take the stranger in, he will be taken away to jail or to a concentration camp. Taking him in carries risks, but not taking him in, there's no risk. He's just going to be hurt. And then on top of all that, I'd say that whatever you decide, as you're thinking about it, what you're actually going to do may be quite different. Your heart or your head, your cowardice or your bravery may kick in ways that you don't anticipate when you're calmly reflecting on these things. And for me, that's part of the excitement, the exhilaration, and also the humility of just being alive, that I'm going to put down this phone after I've talked to you for approximately 50 minutes on the subject of help. The phone's going to ring again, and maybe it's going to be someone who needs me. And for all my words and for all of our good discussion, I'm still left with that decision. And in some ways, I'm glad. It means I'm not dead.
Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm thinking about rewards. Sometimes it's easier for people to accept a gift of help if you clearly define your own benefit, the giver's benefit. For instance, there are some international students that we know that will be going back, and they were talking about having to buy suitcases. Well, I've got some suitcases in the attic. We already helped them with a number of things, and I'd like to get rid of those suitcases. If I can convey that they'd be doing me a favor if they can take the suitcases off my hand, it might be easier for them to accept that help. That's just one simple example. But thinking about this whole issue of religion and rewards, and something I've been thinking about for a long time, to me it seems better to reward yourself, if need be, to find reasons for doing things, than to expect a reward from a deity. To me, that's more like bribery. I'll do this if you'll give me eternal life, is a crass, blunt way of putting it. There was something else I was going to say, and now, doggone it, it's gone out of my head. But lately I've been dealing with elderly relatives and trying to help them as they need it. And one of the books that I read that was had some helpful insights on how to be, how to do this so that it works for all involved was, it's called Another Country by Mary Pfeiffer. And it's about the differences in the worldviews of elders and younger generations. And she gives some examples of different places where people have succeeded in helping. And in one, she talks about an American Indian culture, I don't remember what the group is, where it's considered an honor to help elders and to find out what they need and to do it. And the elder expects help and accepts it as something that is okay to accept. And that it's interesting trying to figure out how to find how to essentially become the parent of your parents as time goes on, which is a whole different, more complex, it adds more complexity, this whole issue of helping, because you're changing roles and all these expectations and past experiences that come into play as compared to helping a stranger. And there was something else I was going to say, but it's gone, and it'll just have to be gone. So anyway, that's what I wanted to contribute.
All right. Well, Mr. Cash, you want to reflect on
yes,
any of that?
A lot of material there, and just a few things. First of all, I think there's a lot of wisdom in what this woman said about defining your own benefits for the person you're trying to help, if for no other reason than to add some dignity to their predicament. One of the people that I talk about in my book is a man named André Trocmé, who was working in the resistance during World War II and rescuing Jews from the Nazis. And someone said of him later that he was the kind of person who made you feel as if you were helping him, even though he was in the act of helping you. She also talked a little bit about you know, why people do things as far as receiving a reward from the deity or a reward from themselves. And I think that's one of those questions of motive we've visited before. And I'll say the same thing again, that it's an important question, although I think it's important not to get hung up on the question. If I'm in a building and it's burning down and someone pulls me out because they think they'll go to heaven, you know, I hope they go, frankly, and I'm quite happy as long as I get out of the building. And the same thing goes for if they do it just because they want their picture in the paper. What she said about the Native American culture is interesting in that it shows that we can create a better culture of helping, that it's possible to have certain cultural norms in place that tell us, not everything, but some of what she was getting at in how we become our parents' child. And I think those things are every bit as important to work on as how to build faster computers.
All right. I appreciate comments of the call. Let's go on to somebody else here. We have someone on a cell phone. This would be line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Hi, I wanted to comment on the previous caller and just point out on a philosophical level that according to Immanuel Kant, the moral value of something that you do is diminished to the extent that you benefit from that act. And therefore, to some extent, people who do good deeds because they want to go to heaven are actually, there's less moral value to that than if they didn't believe in God and didn't believe in an afterlife. And another thing that I wanted to point out is that I find myself in a peculiar situation because I throw things out. It's just one of the things I do. And I often give them to people. And I have two reactions to that. One is if you give people enough things, they start to get very resentful. And I think they feel a sense, at least in this country, that there's a moral indebtedness to you. And you can't convince them that it isn't there. They have no, they don't owe you anything in that sense. And also that when you give something to someone that you don't want, and they do this to me all the time, and they'll talk about you're very generous. And I said, I don't understand. I can either take it to the Salvation Army or I can give it to you. Why is there generosity involved if there's no sacrifice to me to do something for you? Why do you consider that a generous act? And the response I get is usually that it's a lot of people who would just throw things out. It would never occur to them to give it to someone else. And I don't know if those are typical just American attitudes or world attitudes or, you know, something that's in the human species that we don't want to feel that connected, at least in the sense of obligation. Maybe you would want to comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, in answer to the question why someone might view this as generous, a gift that you give, even when you are only giving because you want to unload something, I think points to the mutuality in the way that I defined the word help, that from that person's point of view, that's something that he or she needs. So your motive isn't what's uppermost in their mind. What's uppermost in their mind is the gift and how that gift is helping them. Of course, we know cases of you know, using the poor basically as the recycling station in the garbage can. Whenever somebody has something they can't throw out anywhere that no landfill will take, they usually bring it to a church. As far as the moral value of acts, not being either a philosopher or a divinity, I'm in no place to judge that. And frankly, after a certain point, it stops interesting me what the moral value is of an act, whether someone did something because they are going to heaven, they want to go to heaven, or whether they're doing it for selfless reasons, assuming those exist. Some days I write because I want to benefit humanity. Some days I write because I'm overcome by a wave of inspiration. And some days I write because the bill for my daughter's tuition came and I need to find a way to pay it. The important thing is that I'm writing. And I'm not sure that the value or the quality of my writing varies according to those three motives. I think what's important is that I take what I have, whatever it is, and that I act in a creative way in doing what my work is in this time and place. And my approach to these questions tends to be situational, existential, right here and now, the question that we're always visited with, what are you going to do? Hmm. And then you either do it or you don't.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, real quick, I should introduce again our guest, Garrett Kaiser. He's a writer. He's author of a book that explores this subject that we have been talking about here this morning. The title of his book is Help, The Original Human Dilemma, published by Harper San Francisco. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Folks, if you want to call in, toll-free 800-222-9455. You, back in the beginning, we talked a little bit about the fact that your perhaps your desire to explore the subject had to do with a couple of reaction to a couple of ideas, one being that all problems can be reduced to easy formulas, and you can give somebody a simple set of rules you can apply to any situation so they'll know what to do. The other is that we have this idea perhaps now, a lot of people have this idea that one's self is the most important person to help. Given that we are have now become a culture that's interested in, to say the least, in self-help, has that affected the way that we think about helping others, do you think?
I think so. I'm glad you repeated those ideas that I'm opposing in my book. And I don't want to be dogmatic. I think the fundamental impulse behind the self-help movement is a healthy one, and that is that I look at, before I save the world, I need to look at myself, and I need to take care of some things, and I also want to do whatever I can, in addition to what doctors, counselors can do, to make myself a happier, healthier person and to make the people around me happier and healthier. That's all sound, good stuff. Where I start to take exception is where people sort of take that self-help ethos and use it as a way to kind of inject a sense of spirituality and righteousness into a fairly self-serving, self-satisfied, middle-class existence, in which, I sort of take care of my problems and I cultivate my own garden and I quiet my own mind. And in a world where children are starving and don't have health care, and in a country where people are earning, a substandard minimum wage, well, those problems are important, but I can't think about that right now because I'm helping myself, and I think that's preciousness, frankly. And I'm very susceptible to that form of preciousness myself. That's why I think I can recognize it for what it is. It's the sin of which I am guilty.
Another caller here, someone in Chicago, someone else in Chicago, line number four. Hello.
Thank you. I'd like to go back to an aspect you spoke about, the animals. Well, we have an example here in Chicago where a child fell into the gorilla cage and the gorilla came forth, and everybody was wondering what's going to happen. The gorilla simply picked up the baby and cradled it so they could be rescued. And then you have examples of the porpoises surrounding somebody, guiding the person to shore, and other examples of cats and dogs awakening or helping some injured person in the family. So we have those beautiful examples of the animals helping and caring for us. And then I'd like to comment about Gandhi's expression of the earth has enough resources for mankind's need, but not mankind's greed. To the extent that it expresses a sharing and caring for those needs, we can all be better off. And certainly the thing that steps in the way is the insecurity and the results of the greed and the exploitation and so forth. I just thought I'd make those comments.
All right. Well, Mr. Garza, you want to react?
Yeah, I'm so glad he did. The Gandhi one is easy. All I have to say to that is amen. And as far as the example he gave of the gorilla and the porpoises, it does show, I think, that help is not something exclusive to humans. But it also almost amounts to a parable for humans, or at least I hear it as such. I ask myself, if a gorilla would step forward to protect a baby or a child that had fallen into a cage and would reach out even to another species, what would we say of ourselves if we refuse to help the children who fall into the cage and the danger of poverty and racism and degradation in our own society, if a gorilla would step forward to rescue that child? And if we fancy ourselves as more evolved than gorillas, then what must we do?
Hmm. We're at the point we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say, when we have a caller we can't take. The book, obviously, very quickly, once one gets into it, you realize that this whole business of helping and thinking about it is much more complicated than probably you thought about it when you. I mean, I'm talking about my own reaction to the book. Maybe I should do it that way. It's much more complicated than I thought at the beginning, and you explore this in many different dimensions and take it in a lot of different directions. So a lot of things I think to think about in the book. But, having said that, as a result of your doing this, at the end of the day, did you feel that you came away with any better understanding of helping than you had when you started?
I think perhaps I did. I think I came away from, you know, reading and talking to people with an understanding of, you know, the complexity of motives and all the possibilities of outcome that are involved. But I think that what I came away with the most, or what was most important for me personally, was the idea that was the knowledge that there were other people out there who were wrestling with the same questions, and wrestling with them even at greater levels of intensity that I do in my life. One of my favorite reviews of this book came from my wife, who, after she read the manuscript, said, "It makes me feel better about the work that I do." And likewise, talking to people like her and like the ones I interviewed in the book, it gave me the sense that I'm not wrestling with these questions alone. And that's one of the things I hope the book gives to its readers, not only a sense of, as you say, how complex this issue is, but the fact that they are not alone in it, and that there are other people exploring that complexity side by side with them.
Well, there we will stop with the recommendation that people look at the book. There's much to think about. It's titled Help, The Original Human Dilemma, published by Harper San Francisco, by our guest, Garrett Keizer. If you look for the book, his name's spelled K-E-I-Z-E-R. And thanks very much, Mr. Keizer. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David. I've enjoyed this very much.